From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and after a long break, Philippe Gillet, U.S. Chief Correspondent for Le Figaro. Welcome back to the program, Philippe.
Thank you.
And here are the issues. In his first week as president, Donald Trump issued a blizzard of executive orders on issues ranging from health insurance to building a wall on the border with Mexico. Analysts questioned the feasibility of many of these measures, and the president of Mexico canceled a planned visit to Washington. President Trump continued to insist without evidence that the election, in which he won the Electoral College but lost the popular vote, was characterized by massive fraud. He promised an investigation. And finally, Trump opponents weighed steps to follow up on the post-inaugural women's marches, which brought millions of women and men into the streets of Washington and other major cities. Linda, we're going to start with the blizzard of executive orders. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like it. He sat in the Oval Office and signed and signed and signed. He withdrew from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Mm-hmm. There is a new gag rule on funding for organizations that provide abortion services and other health services for women overseas. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's the wall. Mm-hmm. What stood out to you among all of these?
A couple of things. One, every new president from if it's a change of party, sits down and signs a bunch of executive orders, reversing actions of the previous president. So on one level, this is nothing new. Now, what is new is the magnitude of some of the orders and the issues that he's dealing with. Donald Trump wants to show strength and power and leadership. And one way he can do that is signing these orders. Some of them are more mission statements. For example, on healthcare, he signed this order telling government that if it's a burden, they don't have to enforce the law completely. But it's not like he was able to rescind Obamacare with the stroke of a pen. Mm-hmm. So this is a lot of show, the building of the wall. Mm-hmm. He can't, with the stroke of a pen, order, say, $15 billion of government spending to build the wall. But what he was able to do was order a DHS, Department of Homeland Security, to begin the wall and to repurpose funds that already exist in the department.
In order to start it. Philippe, there are a lot of questions about this wall. I mean, 2,000 miles long. It goes through, in some cases, areas that are very, very difficult to have construction in. It goes through areas that are owned by Native American populations that are part of their reservations. Why is this wall so important to Donald Trump?
Well, it's a good question because actually it seems that this is not the proper answer to the real immigration problem that there is at the border because it's no longer essentially Mexicans trying to cross illegally. The issue is more about Central American refugees asking for asylum in the U.S. So they don't necessarily cross the border in wild areas where, you know, there is no surveillance. I mean, they go to border points and they ask for political asylum. So, I mean, at some point, probably Donald Trump will have to explain why he still thinks that this wall is more than an electoral slogan and an actual useful project.
You reminded me, actually, there was a kind of parody on social media. I forget who put it out, but it showed that a lot of the people who were coming from Central America are actually coming on airplanes.
Yeah.
And it pointed out that a wall would have absolutely nothing to do with them flying into the United States and seeking asylum when they land. Linda, the announcement, the executive order and the insistence on the wall, though, has had an immediate impact on U.S. relations with Mexico, mm-hmm. which were already kind of shaky after the election.
Right. So Donald Trump, of course, has insisted that Mexico will pay for the wall. And Mexico says, no, we will not. And in his unique way, Donald Trump communicates with the world on significant issues via Twitter. And so he tweeted out that if Mexico will not pay for the wall, then President Peña Nieto should consider not coming, which was Donald Trump's way of saying, don't come. And so the Mexican president canceled his visit, which is not a good way to start a relationship with one of your two neighbors.
Yeah, also our third major trading partner.
Yes.
Yeah.
When you think about it, it doesn't make sense. I mean, to pretend all along the campaign that we will build this wall and Mexico will pay for it, I mean, it's adding humiliation to punishment. And I don't think he ever thought that the Mexican government would write a check to the United States for paying the war. I think his obsession is the trade deficit with Mexico, which is roughly $60 billion. And his intention from the start was to reduce this deficit and argue that the money, by reducing this deficit, would pay for the war. Because, I mean, any sound person cannot expect that a country that
Mexico would pay for it one way or the other.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Donald Trump is a businessman, and he's all about using leverage to get the best deal. Mm-hmm. And so he's looking at the various economic relationships between the U.S. and Mexico. There's the issue of remittances. Lots of Mexicans in this country who send money back home, he could tax remittances. The U.S.-Mexican financial relationship is enormous. And, you know, I know people who actually are convinced that Mexico will, in effect, pay for this wall one way or the other. And whether, you know, the building of walls literally and metaphorically is the right way to build the global economy is another question. But
Well, in line with that, Philippe, the idea now has come forward that the United States will recoup some of the cost of the wall by putting a so-called border tax on Mexican imports. And this is part of a larger congressional tax reform plan. But it seems to me that this could provoke a lot of retaliation and a trade war.
First of all, it's the end of NAFTA. Mm-hmm. If you impose a border tax, be it 20% or any other level, it's de facto the end of NAFTA. Mm-hmm. So probably you would have to put that into the context of denouncing the treaty or rewriting the treaty. Again, I think I see it as a kind of posturing on the part of the president. I'm not sure he has already studied in detail the downfalls and the upsides of NAFTA, for instance. I mean, NAFTA obviously deserves to be modernized. There are a lot of things that are not in the treaty, like e-commerce, and a lot of things that did not exist in the 90s. But he's saying that he will just destroy it. And that's followed, I think, in the rest of the world very closely, because it's kind of a first example of how he will make his first steps on the international scene. Mm-hmm. And there is also this draft presidential order that may cut the U.S. funding in international organizations.
Right, for the UN.
Mm-hmm. You may have seen that. I mean, everything he's done so far has been about destroying things that he doesn't like. But we haven't seen yet any new proposal or any new ideas to replace what he wants to destroy.
There are other orders that are out there, Linda. Sanctuary cities, so-called, are going to be targeted. What's a sanctuary city?
Sanctuary city refers to a jurisdiction in which they have told local officials they do not need to carry out the federal role of immigration control. So, for example, if a police officer pulls over somebody for a traffic violation and determines that they are or may be an illegal immigrant, they don't have to turn them over to the authorities. So Trump's leverage on that is he's saying he will cut federal funding to these jurisdictions as essentially as punishment for shielding undocumented
people. Can he
people.
Do that? I mean, can he stop, for example, you know, Medicaid money or Medicare money or social? I mean, what does he mean by federal payments?
I think any federal money. I mean, and he, you know, what I don't know is if he can just do that by executive order or does it have to go through Congress? I don't know. But Donald Trump, I don't think, asks these questions. I think he just does and then worries about the consequences later.
Yeah.
I think we're going to see a big fight in courts.
Sure.
About that.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Full employment for lawyers.
Right. And of course, most cities in America are governed by Democrats. That's mm-hmm. Urban America is the center of Democratic America. And so you've got big city mayors all over the country fighting back and saying they're going to help these people. You know, in Boston, the mayor said they can come stay in City Hall if need be. So we're already getting a big battle going between the cities and Washington and Democrats versus Republicans. Yeah.
Mayor Bill de Blasio of New York said, quote, "We're going to defend all of our people, regardless of where they come from, regardless of their immigration status." Philippe, there are also executive orders on refugees and people trying to come to this country from 7 Muslim nations. The refugee executive order will, as expected, stop Syrians from coming. And it's still unclear, I think, how long these restrictions would be in operation on people from countries such as Iran, Iraq, Libya, Sudan, Yemen, and...
Somalia,
yeah.
And there is no... Afghanistan is not on the list.
Yeah, and neither is
enough.
Pakistan or Saudi Arabia or the United Arab Emirates. Of course, the 9/11 hijackers, or Egypt, 9/11 hijackers came from Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt, if my memory serves.
But there is a part of mystery about this list. On the other hand, I think this is a kind of decision that gets quite a lot of support among Trump's supporters and voters. It may be seen as a precautionary measure. I mean, like, we have to vet those people. So for 30 days, we're going to suspend visa delivery to...
But these people are being vetted. I mean,
They are, of course.
You know, I spoke to someone who told me that Iranian men, for example, adult men, have to be screened by, I don't know, something like 19 different organizations in the United States and
but
abroad
again,
before they get a visa.
It's Trump, so it's all about saying things, taking a public position, and then maybe realizing that what he offered already exists and just put his name on it. I mean, we have the salesman in chief at the White House. So it's what he wants to show is action. And I think he confounds often action with movement.
Yeah.
He has to move. He said he wants an event every day.
Right.
And we're going to have an event every day.
I feel sorry for the White House press corps. We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of All Monitor. Joining me today are Philippe Gellet of Le Figaro and Linda Feldman of the Christian Science Monitor. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Have we gone through all the executive orders, or are there more? I think that's a good accounting of them, Linda. But I wanted to talk about a couple of other things that President Trump said and also his top advisors in recent days. He has continued to talk about fraud in the election that he won, and to insist that there were millions of fraudulent votes, but only in favor of Hillary Clinton, none in favor of him, which, of course, would be a statistical impossibility if fraud occurred on that level. Why is he doing this, and why does it bother him so much?
This goes to the essence of Donald Trump. Donald Trump is all about being the biggest and the best, and he's obsessed with size, the size of the crowds at his inauguration. He was furious when pictures went out showing that he had a smaller crowd than Barack Obama did for his first inauguration. That is an indisputable fact. Barack Obama had the biggest turnout ever for presidential inauguration, at least in modern times. And Donald Trump just can't compete with that. And why he continues to press this, I think, tells us something important about his personality. Now, this issue of the popular vote being allegedly fraudulent, he has said between 3 and 5 million illegal immigrants voted in the election, and that's why he lost the popular vote. And that is, he's presented no evidence and has now said he will have an investigation. We don't know how, who will investigate, but this is, as I said, quintessential Trump, a lot of bluster and unsubstantiated claims.
Yeah, Philippe apparently was so upset about the comparisons between his inaugural crowd and President Obama's inaugural crowd in 2009 that he actually ordered the Parks Department to give him different photos, to give him a different angle on
and
the
he pressured
event.
Pressured the head of the National Park Services. I think this goes to the very heart of the divide between the elites and the Trump supporters. I mean, on the one hand, if you're a rational person, it doesn't make sense. I mean, it doesn't make sense to pretend that 3 to 5 million people have voted illegally and only for your opponent. It doesn't even make sense to launch an inquiry on that because the result might probably prove you wrong. But on the other hand, I think his supporters are pretty much on his side on this. And they think that he shouldn't comply with the common belief that everything is all right and that he should check. And if even if in the end nothing is proven of what he said, at least he didn't submit himself to this, the general consensus, if you want. He's broken it. And I think if he can find a way to get out of this to his advantage, and that's why he's doing it.
Well, also, it opens the way for more voter suppression, Linda, right? More voter ID laws and so on that make it harder for people who tend to vote Democratic to vote in the next elections.
That's right. And, you know, we've seen a lot of efforts in these regards, but we have the man who will become the attorney general, Jeff Sessions, is from Alabama, a very Republican southern state. He does support the showing of ID. Now, elections in this country are run at the local level, and so the federal government can't order a voter ID requirement for elections, but certainly the climate of suspicion that Donald Trump is promoting, I think, would perhaps support that position. But I also wanted to say that I think what we're seeing here, sort of some of the context, is a decline in trust in American society of institutions, whether
sure,
a decline
sure.
in trust in government or the media or the church, just any major institutions. And so when Trump says something and the media come back and say, this is wrong, this is, you're lying, his supporters come back and just dismiss it. They just don't believe what the media is saying.
Yeah, Philippe, Steve Bannon, one of President Trump's most prominent advisors, gave an interview to the New York Times in which he basically told reporters to shut up and that the New York Times, which President Trump reads faithfully, you know, humiliated itself because it didn't see the Trump victory coming. And so reporters should just shut their mouths and listen, as he put it. And of course, fighting against the press has always been popular for certain politicians. I certainly remember Richard Nixon was not terribly fond of the media either.
Yeah, well, it's always been popular. I think for this administration, for this president, it's more than popular, it's crucial. I mean, it's all about the war on facts. If you demean the traditional media as being out of touch with the reality in the country, then when they come out with something that is embarrassing, I mean, it's much easier to dismiss it. And I think also that Steve Bannon, first of all, I think it's one of the most interesting characters in this White House, definitely.
Yeah.
I think he will play the guardian of the movement and that he will be the one, I mean, in case after a few months, Donald Trump is tempted to play by the old rules and play nice with Congress and so on and so forth, I think Bannon will be there to say, no, this is not why you've been elected. And
Taking advantage of your presence here, I wanted to ask you also, Steve Bannon has an interesting relationship with similar sort of populace in Europe. I'm thinking of Marine Le Pen and so on.
Right.
And there's an effort to portray this as a sort of worldwide movement now. It's not just the United States, but it's Brexit in England. We have, of course, Theresa May in Washington. What's your sense of how this is playing now in France in particular?
I think there is some truth to the point he's made that this is a kind of a worldwide Tea Party movement, although, of course, the characteristics differ a lot from one country to another. But there is definitely this populist and anti-immigration and anti-system and trends all around Europe, especially in France. I mean, we are having a presidential election late April and early May. And according to the polls, Marine Le Pen, who is ahead of the Front National, which is the far-right party in France, she's still ahead in the polls. And it's very strange what we are looking at, because coming second is François Fillon, who is also very conservative. So you might have a second round of the French presidential election without the left, which is still supposed to represent at least, I mean, a small half of the country, but they could be absent of the second round. And two candidates, I mean, one from the far right and one from the religious conservative part of the center-right movement. So,
and recently damaged by a scandal over giving half $1 million to his wife.
That's the question mark right now on his candidacy, if he can overcome this or not. I mean, if there was an indictment, everything would be upside down again. And all we have had primaries on the right a few months back. Primaries are going on right now among the Socialist Party. If Fillon, who won easily the primary on the right, he's indicted and has to withdraw from. I mean, don't ask me what will happen.
It's chaos, yeah, it's chaos. Linda, I wanted to spend our remaining moments talking about La Résistance. The day after Donald Trump's inauguration, there was the largest demonstration I've ever seen in Washington, and that goes back to, you know, the anti-Vietnam protests of the late 60s and the early 1970s. Well over a quarter of a million people, some people say a million or more in Washington. It exploded outside of the area in which it was supposed to be held, and basically demonstrators took over all of downtown Washington on Saturday afternoon after the inauguration. What is your sense of this movement and where it's going? I mentioned resistance. Greenpeace put up a sign saying resist off a construction crane just behind the White House, stopping traffic and getting some interesting photos also just the other day.
No, this is a fascinating development. I don't think anybody expected this to take off the way it has. It was a social media phenomenon, not only in Washington, but all over the country. We had 3 or 4 million protesters, big cities, small cities, basically anywhere. Lots of women, lots of men, lots of children. Men came without women. This is a big support for not just women's rights. That was the heart of the protest, but also for in support of recognizing climate change, recognizing immigrant rights,
gender rights,
rights down the list. So the question is, what to do with this big movement? Is it something that can last? Will it lead to an explosion of for the Democratic Party, which is the vehicle to take on Trump, to revive the party? The Democratic Party has atrophied over the last several years, and can the party take advantage of this new energy and run effective candidates for office and really retake some of take some of the momentum away from the right?
Yeah, Philippe, I think one thing that was very important about these demonstrations was the number of young people who attended. You know, that particularly young women who had taken their rights for granted now realize that they can be taken away in terms of the right to choose and equal pay for equal work and all of these other things. There was a big emphasis on grassroots organizing. Michael Moore, the filmmaker, gave a talk where he basically said, okay, you know, he gave a list of things for people to do. Call your representative in Congress every day, he said. Run for office, starting with school board. He ran for the school board in his local town in Michigan when he was 18 years old. Do you think this is really going to, I mean, turn into something and cause a real difficulty for Trump?
It's hard to say because, well, again, by the way, we should notice that this is also something that the mainstream media mostly missed ahead of time.
Sure.
And it's also something that had an echo in the rest of the world with a lot of demonstrations in a lot of cities around the world. So it's kind of, you know, the negative picture of what's going on the populist side. I went to the demonstration. The people were very nice, very diverse, very tolerant people. But as you mentioned, the list of their motivations is so long and so diverse that I'm not sure that if there is no some sort of leadership that comes out of this, some practical goals, maybe one after the other. I mean, it's a nice picnic.
it was a rather nice claustrophobic picnic,
together,
I have to say.
but for it to become a powerful political movement, it would have some kind of leadership to emerge. Also, what Michael Moore said is nice and correct, but how many of those people will do that?
Yeah.
That's the question.
That is the question, and that is all the time we have. Joining us today were Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Philippe Gilly, U.S. Chief Correspondent for Le Figaro. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Justin Thwaites and Linus Rimkus. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.